Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, July 15th, 2015. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. So how did those negotiators feel about the nuclear deal in Iran now that they may have gotten a full night's sleep? Will the reality sink in as a powerful new era for the Middle East? Here is President Hassan Rouhani with a vote for this new era.
The page of the past 12-year period, which was accompanied by illusions from the world powers and the spreading of these illusions in society and public opinion, has completely turned, and a new chapter has begun.
It's also possible that once they've slept on it, the Iran nuclear deal may also look like a bad hangover. Here's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
They've gambled that in 10 years' time, Iran's terrorist regime will change while removing any incentive for it to do so. In fact, the deal gives Iran every incentive not to change.
There is a long history of cooperation between Iran and the United States, alongside a history of CIA coups and mutual suspicion. There is a powerful tradition of Iranian Jews enriching the culture of Iran for centuries. What do Iranians now say about all of these changes? What is the balance of suspicion and hope for the future among people who have a stake in it? Joining us is Raymond Iriami, an Iranian Jewish American attorney working in New York. Also with us is Narges Bajoli, founder of the Iranian Alliances Across Borders Organization.
It's something that I'm very hopeful about, actually. I think it represents a moment in which finally, after 35 years, Iran can slowly begin to integrate into the international community. And it also presents an opportunity for those in Iran who are not a part of the political elite, who were really suffering under the sanctions, to see some sort of relief in the future.
Do you see it going back to the way it was before the revolution in 79?
No, I don't. And I'm actually, I guess, less optimistic than Narges is. I don't think this moment is much bigger than it is. I think this is strictly about seeking to ensure, and there's a lot of doubts and debates about that, to prevent Iran from going nuclear in the very immediate future of months, maybe years. I don't see this having necessarily positive ramifications for the rest of the issues relating to Iran. And I actually think this deal will do more to make sure that the regime does not change than doing anything for regime change, to the extent that's anybody's goal.
And in the region, Iran has gained significantly since the Iraq War, in that Iraq is no longer really an antagonist. And in the 1980s, they fought a horrible war, Iran and Iraq. Now, Iran is on a much higher profile. Is it better to engage them in this kind of regional power dimension, or is it better to confront them?
Well, there's no question that Iran has gained power. George Bush did a big favor to the Iranian government, taking out the major rival. And now Iran, be with the Shiite denomination, has now exerting influence all over Iraq and beyond. So over the years, we have empowered them, going back to the years of the post-revolution, the Iran-Iraq war. And now they are a force that they have to be dealt with. And look, this is really, at this point in time, the choice was between war and diplomacy. The United States has taken the option of diplomacy, and given what happened with the Iraq war and what a calamity that was, I'm not sure what better options the United States government had, because I don't think war would have been an option at this point.
What could change in your life, in the life of your family, in your existence here in the United States, or for family back in Iran, Narges?
Well, I mean, I think what this means for those of us in the United States with any sort of connection to Iran or not, you know, it remains to be seen sort of when sanctions are lifted, what the parameters of those laws then become afterwards, as far as any sort of connection between the United States and Iran and between Iranian Americans and those in Iran. But I think really, you know, sort of what this presents, and to go back to Raymond's point, is that the economic and political situation in Iran will not change unless these sanctions and this sort of specter of war is taken away, because actually one of the main groups that was calling for these negotiations to happen, for a deal to be made where human rights and civil rights activists in Iran, because with the specter of war there, they were not allowed to do their activities. And now with the potential of this not being there any longer, they're able to kind of work on those issues, which makes it repressive to be able to do civil and political work in Iran. And I think that that's a positive. Now, you know, whether it means that the Islamic Republic will be there or not, I think that's something that activists on the Iran can work towards and shape in the way that they want. But under in the past 5 years, it was impossible to do anything like that.
But more practically and on a personal level, Nargis, do you know Iranians who want to, you know, reconnect with the rest of the world in a tangible way to sort of catch up on what's been going on in the outside world, to show people in the outside world what's been going on in Iran? Do you sense that there's that latent yearning?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, Iran has a population of about 75 million people. Over half of that population is under the age of 35. These are young people who are very connected on the internet. And this is a generation and a group of people who very much yearn to be in touch with the rest of the world. They're highly educated, extremely creative. All of that to say that from the cultural level to the education level, there are people in the universities, in civil society, and across the art world in Iran who are very much looking forward to being in touch and to having these sorts of exchanges be able to happen at this point. I mean, there are so many university groups that would like to be in contact with university groups outside of Iran that haven't been able to be because of these sorts of things. There are a lot of academics who are looking to have their work published abroad, to be able to come to conferences, to be able to invite scholars from abroad into Iran to talk about latest developments, whether in science and technology or the social sciences. And these present opportunities for that realm.
Raymond, do you think there's an option at all for Iran and the Jewish community around the world to reignite the proud narrative of Judaism inside Iran in Persia?
Nothing would make me happier for that to happen. I'm actually, I do happen to be of a Jewish background, and I grew up as an Iranian Jew in Iran up to the age of 10. Obviously, the Jewish history in Iran dates back to 2,700 years. The Jews have been in Iran longer than just about most any other population in Iran. There's a very proud history there, and the population has decreased in the recent decades because of the exodus after the Iranian Revolution. I'm pretty proud that there is still a Iranian Jewish community still staying in Iran. I think that's a testament to the Jewish people of Iran, to the non-Jewish people of Iran, just the fact that for Jews, they made Iran home. Iran is their home, and I hope they stay there, and I hope that over the, like, it will take some decades and centuries for the Jewish community to grow in Iran and become a more vital part of the Iranian community. But again, I thank God they have managed to persevere.
Can you both take me back to the moments that you remember about the sort of family mythology of how you left Iran and how you might want to reverse that and actually return on some level? You were 10 when you left, Raymond?
I was 10, and I would love to, when I have children of my own, to take them back to show that, hey, this is where your parents grew up. This is your ancestral homeland, and teach them about all of the beautiful aspects of the country, the culture, and the civilization. And I'm told that from people who have gone back to their own homelands, that my going back will be a bittersweet experience, because even though there will be a lot of joy with going back to see the streets where I grew up, there will also be some sadness involved, because I will realize, and I kind of already know it now, that the streets where I grew up may no longer belong there.
Mm. What's your most vivid memory of that home?
Well, I have so many memories from the revolution, from the war, from how when the war started, my priority was, okay, well, can we go exchange my birthday gifts before the war really starts? When the sirens would ring in those early days, hiding in the basements, but within weeks being back on the roof to watch the anti-aircraft missiles fly, because it just became a source of entertainment. I have memories of being treated as a Jew in some ways, actually, with a lot of respect, because they felt that we would not harm other people because we're Jewish. So there was some positive stereotypes that went along with being Jewish. just in terms of all aspects of life, the revolution happening, the regime changing, that was very scary, and I was a very young boy at the time. So, you know, that was really home. And again, I would love to go back.
And what are your memories of departure?
Well, I was extremely young.
Right.
My family ended up having to leave very hurriedly because my father was a leftist activist. And after they tried to stay after the revolution, but after a while, it just wasn't feasible for them because a lot of their friends were being taken away. And so we left very hurriedly through Europe and ended up in the United States. I have very, you know, little memories of the time except for the sirens from the war. Those, you know, the sort of very traumatic things that were happening have stayed in my mind. But I've gone back many times and lived there in my adult life. And so those, for me, the Iran that I know is more so as a teenager and an adult than as a child.
And it's alive and well if the governments and the international community get out of the way. You could live there.
I did live there for pretty much my entire 20s. And, you know, it's a difficult question. I've always thought about, could I live there for longer? And I think that until certain social changes are made, it would be something that at this point in my life, no longer being an adventurous, you know, 20-something-year-old and thinking about other things at this point, it would be something that I would have to think harder about. And certain changes have to be made within Iran first.
Raymond Iriami is an Iranian Jewish-American attorney working here in New York. Narges Bajoli is founder of the Iranian Alliances Across Borders. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now here's something on the minds of the Takeaway Gang this week, staff, friends, and listeners.
This is Catherine in Dallas, Texas. Male and female athletes are held to different standards when it comes to their looks. Male athletes are lionized for the rugged, masculine, gladiator-type looks, scars and all. But female athletes are shamed if they look like anything less than perfect Barbie dolls.
This conversation comes out of a lot of thoughtful consideration of the events of the last week in which the U.S. women's soccer team won the World Cup. They are not Barbie dolls, but they are quite likely familiar with what Catherine there is talking about. Last week, Serena Williams won Wimbledon for the sixth time. A Barbie doll she is not, which is something that Serena is both aware of and has spoken about in the past. The New York Times spoke to her about the subject of body image in a story last week that a large number of people thought was yet another tacit endorsement of this double standard for women. Sports editor at the Times, Jason Stallman, defended the story, and you'll hear him speak about the criticism he has received in a few minutes. Here he tries to say that body image is a subject that athletes talk about all the time for all kinds of reasons.
All of these players do think a great deal about their bodies, both for image reasons, but also for how it allows them to play their sport. And Serena explained that she stays away from weights because she feels like she gets bulked up. Her muscles are big enough without weight training that if she did hit the weights, it would be excessive. And she works with other things like, you know, stretching bands, and she feels that that's a better training technique for her. And this is, you know, this is why, among the reasons I think writing about athletes' bodies is an important thing, because in sports, the athlete's body is important, right, all the time. That is their main tool. So whether it's, you know, a baseball pitcher's shoulder or a javelin thrower's hands or a tennis player's legs, like, these are the tools of the trade, and the athletes themselves take them quite seriously and spend a lot of time shaping them and stretching them and making them the best they possibly can for their sport. And it's interesting to hear them talk about that.
But are some athletes under pressure to keep their tools from being the best for their sport because it would look bad in the mirror or not meet some other criteria of beauty? Pulak Panir says muscle is good only up to a point.
I'm pretty petite, so I definitely am cautious of the amount of weight that I put on the bars and stuff. I'm happy with a comfortable weight and lifting and getting tone, but I don't necessarily do the prescribed, you know, extreme weights here. I just think for my size, I would look a little off.
We caught up with Pulak Panir at a CrossFit gym in Manhattan. But at a gym on 6th Avenue in New York City, Vanessa has no problem with strength.
I'm not afraid to put on some muscle because in real life, in science, having muscle on your body helps to burn fat and keeps you healthy for a longer amount of time, and I want to live as long as possible.
I've never avoided any particular exercise for fear of it making me look muscular. I mean, I like the muscles that I have, but I still have curves.
Allison Bedarsky there is a trainer at the Black Box CrossFit Gym on 28th Street in Manhattan. She represents an evolution of body image to a place where there is no apparent contradiction between muscle and curves.
When I put my uniform on, I feel a very specific way about my body. Like, oh, like my arms look very muscly right now because like I'm carrying my lacrosse stick and I'm going to shoot the ball.
And here's Bronwyn Schumacher, who played 4 years of NCAA Division III lacrosse at Oberlin College before she graduated.
I got to see all of these different women that had different types of bodies and yet were able to do so many different things. Understanding that like different bodies are still capable of doing amazing things on the field and in the weight room helped me realize that like that our bodies are machines. It's not just about what they look like. And that really helped me love my own body.
Schumacher told us that at the collegiate level, there's much less pressure than there is for professional athletes. But she discovered a personal limit to how much she wanted her body to be a tool on the lacrosse field.
When we started doing intense weight training, I dropped some weight. And I knew that I was a little excited about it. But my coach was saying, like, oh, you're too skinny. Like, you're not bulky enough. You're going to get knocked over too easily. You need to gain 10 pounds. But then when I eventually did do that, now I'm 10 pounds heavier, I find myself, like, wishing that I were the skinnier, lither version of myself.
Bronwyn told us it's sometimes more comfortable on the field with other athletes than on the street, where women have to compete with every idealized model on every magazine cover and in every store window.
Female athlete bodies are normalized in an athletic sphere because everybody's like them, but once you put them in contact with the rest of the world, your quads are just really big and like your arms are just like really big.
Do female athletes feel this pressure more keenly than men? Are women forced to worry about giving up their looks to have a successful sports career? From New Jersey, we heard an adamant yes, absolutely. Women athletes show any amount of what some members of our society call masculine muscles, and they are looking like men, and God forbid they gain any amount of weight. They are called all sorts of insulting names, yet haven't they ever seen half of the pro football or baseball players? They have big guts, they can't run for beans, but there is no mention of that whatsoever. Complete gender discrimination. I'm so sick of it, I almost block it out completely. This is not just a man's world anymore, but they keep trying.
This is Kathy from Dallas.
This is Robert calling from Miami.
Zach Rouse in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, my name is Denise, and I'm calling from Seneca, South Carolina.
Of course, female athletes are expected to be attractive in the standards. If she wears short hair, has a muscular build, and wears no makeup, there's an assumption that she's a lesbian.
But not because they are athletes. It's because they are women.
Women are brutal with each other. Men are generally very impressed with superior athletes, regardless of gender. At least I am.
So if a male athlete is really good looking, am I to assume that he's gay?
Being buff is part of male attractiveness.
It's a double standard.
Women are valued more for being petite, soft, delicate, even fragile.
A double standard for sure.
There was a recent photo spread done. The woman is an Olympic hammer thrower. The pictures were just gorgeous of her. And the best part about it is there's someone that we can point at and say, this is an Olympic athlete, and she looks like me.
Me? I'd take Serena Williams over, say, Sarah Jessica Parker any day of the week.
Call us at 8778-MYTAKE or find us on Twitter at The Takeaway. This conversation continues in just a moment.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. From LegalZoom, for over 10 years working to help Americans navigate the legal system, with assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. And Lumosity.com. Introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
So now to the New York Times article that set all of this discussion on body image into motion. Here's the headline. Tennis's top women balance body image with ambition. It appeared in the Times the day before Serena Williams heroically won Wimbledon.
And without noting any problem with this, the Times quoted a number of athletes who chose not to emulate Serena Williams' quote, large biceps and mold-breaking muscular frame. Many readers wanted to know why the Times would publish an article that to them seemed to denigrate Serena Williams' accomplishments by noting her large size and winning strength. Joshua Du Bois tweeted, "Reaction to Serena piece not overblown, premise and execution both classically racist and shot through with implicit bias." Feminist writer Roxane Gay tweeted, "That New York Times article on Serena's body is so misguided and racist and utter trash." Earlier this week, Margaret Sullivan, public editor of the Times, took up the concerns, quote, "I see this article as a missed opportunity to really get under the surface of a pervasive and troubling issue in women's sports, and particularly women's tennis." To the Times' credit, they did speak with Serena Williams, who spoke candidly about how she has had to learn how to love her body, being a professional tennis player. I sat down with Jason Stallman, the Times sports editor, who claims that his freelancer, Ben Rothenberger, who wrote the piece, and four Times editors, three of whom were female, understood the sensitivity of this subject when they greenlighted the article.
Serena has pretty firmly established herself as the greatest tennis player of our generation, probably the best female player ever. Ben Rothenberg covers the sport probably more comprehensively than anyone. He's with these players day in and day out for much of the year. He picked up on something pretty interesting playing out that nobody had really explored before, and that is that, you know, Serena's rise to dominance has partly been attributed to her power game. She hits the ball a lot harder than most of her opponents, and it enables her to control matches. So he started wondering why other women's players didn't try to kind of match her stroke for stroke in that way. And it turns out that, you know, many of them very candidly explained to Ben that they don't want to reshape their bodies in that way, that they want to maintain a slimmer, a more traditionally known girly figure. And we just thought this was a inherently interesting notion that female athletes were having to make such a decision, and that many of the top professionals in the world were making that choice not to bulk up, as they said.
And the pitch was based on responses to the question, why haven't you matched Serena's success in the power game? She's apparently willing to have a body image that other tennis players aren't willing to have.
Right. You know, Serena spoke quite openly with Ben about her own body and how, you know, it took her a while to sort of have some level of self-acceptance. She, you know, she has said that she even covers her arms when she's in public sometimes because her arm muscles are so big. And, you know, she said she stays away from weightlifting because she doesn't need that to gain any more bulk. So with Serena speaking so openly about this issue and having other players discuss their own situation, we thought that was just really interesting material for a story that hadn't been told before.
So when Claire Potter posted in outhistory.org in a quote that was taken by your public editor and published in the Times, "I don't know why I am surprised that the New York Times would publish a piece that supports female body hatred, that a male reporter would support such a narrow beauty standard for women, or that women's tennis players would be proud of their endless willingness to be gender police for each other. But I am surprised." How do you respond to that?
I guess, with all due respect to Ms. Potter and our public editor, I'm just a little astonished that people think we should ignore these issues and not write about them. You know, the New York Times wasn't taking the position on female body image. We were letting the tennis players speak for themselves. And as professional athletes and adults, I think I'd rather allow them to make the case for how they handle their bodies rather than for us try to make that for them. So, you know, the public editor's piece was met with a lot of laughter and eyebrow raising in the newsroom. I'm still digging through emails of kind of shock from the position she took that we should advocate certain ways in our news stories that would certainly defy about 150 years of New York Times tradition.
But Rothenberg himself says, "I should have challenged the norms rather than just stated them as a given."
Right. I think, you know, I wasn't there when Ben spoke with the public editor. I think what he's saying was he should have asked the tennis players these follow-up questions. I don't know that we would necessarily adopt those opinions as our own. And that seems to be a lot of the negative reaction has been that the New York Times didn't advocate a certain way. And that's just not our position. It seems that people take exception to what the tennis players and their coaches were saying, which is one thing, but we didn't have a position on the issue.
Among the conversations that came out of that piece around here was someone who said that a fantastic elementary school athlete, black girl, is training and trying to figure out what sort of sport she could go into, and it could be any. And her mother told her that, you know, she doesn't want her to play tennis or basketball because she doesn't want her to end up looking like that, all muscled up. And everyone sort of understood what the mom was saying. Do you think this situation for women is something that is handed to them, you know, at birth by some sort of sociological set of rules? Or is it something that's reinforced by the media and is kept going? And if it weren't for various external factors, would just sort of go away?
It's a great question. I can't pretend to have a level of expertise to know the answer. I will say that I find the reaction to athletes like Serena Williams interesting because they're so varied, right? One of the female staff members here said that she thought it was invigorating Saturday to watch the Wimbledon final with her daughter and think that, great, for once she can watch sports and look at an athlete who is curvy and not, you know, extremely thin and look up to that person and think that could be me someday.
Do you think there's a question of Serena's race in all of this that's unstated? And did you have any discussions with Rothenberg about that?
We talked about that. It is, it's certainly there, and we can't avoid that, that people could read this that way. She and her sister Venus have encountered no shortage of various levels of discrimination throughout their lives and careers because of that. But once we had Serena herself speaking so openly about this and the other players, we thought that that crossed the threshold for us for being justifiable to explore this issue.
Well, for all of the pain and suffering and success that you had in this particular piece, you're a part of it as well. And thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, John. I guess if there is, you know, one thing I would like to emphasize, it's that this was treated as an extremely sensitive and fraught issue, and we, you know, did our best to talk through these things and get a variety of viewpoints involved before we published. And, you know, regardless of people's reactions, we, you know, hope to do a better job next time and keep exploring these difficult subjects.
Thanks, Jason.
Thanks, John.
Jason Stallman, sports editor for The New York Times. This week, there have also been concerns about the largest nuclear arsenal in the world, the U.S. nuclear force that was born 70 years ago with a successful test explosion in the desert of New Mexico that heralded the nuclear age, the superpower arms race, and the Cold War. President Obama, shortly after his inauguration, said he wanted to acknowledge the end of the Cold War with a commitment to reduce America's nuclear arsenal.
So today, I state clearly and with conviction, America's commitment to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons.
The president won a Nobel Peace Prize in part for making promises like this, but in reality, America's nuclear force is fully operational, and in the course of being maintained and modernized for safety reasons, the Pentagon may be quietly upgrading those nuclear weapons with new capabilities not imagined when arms reduction treaties were signed. Len Ackland, a contributor to Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, found that the national labs in Mexico have become a research and development site for some very large defense contractors who appear to want to use modernization as cover to make new nuclear weapons.
The U.S. nuclear weapons industry wields tremendous influence over national security decisions about nuclear weapons. And we examined how this self-branded nuclear enterprise operates in New Mexico, where the first atomic bomb was exploded 70 years ago this week. And we took a close look at a controversial new nuclear bomb being developed at Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque that is said to violate an Obama administration pledge not to build new nuclear weapons with new military capabilities. That bomb, called the B-61-12, is part of a $350 billion plan the U.S. has to modernize nuclear weapons over the next 10 years. Now, the B-61-12 is controversial because it is the first guided nuclear bomb that will enter the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Despite that, the Obama administration and the Pentagon and the nuclear enterprise all say it's simply an upgrade, not a new weapon.
Now, that's because when you say guided, that means it's a warhead delivery system utilizes the smart weapon technology that would be in, say, a cruise missile, that sort of thing?
Exactly. It's guided through radars so that it is much more accurate than the free-fall nuclear bombs currently in the nuclear arsenal.
Now, it was always the case, though, that the federal government was going to spend some money through Lockheed Martin's subsidiary to upgrade weapons, right?
Well, what happened, you know, after the Cold War ended in 91, the U.S. in 92 said it would no longer test nuclear weapons. So the mission of the weapons labs, in particular Sandia, which is the engineering arm of the U.S. nuclear complex, is to ensure the reliability of the bombs in the arsenal. That is being done, but instead of simply testing the parts, including the plutonium in the bombs, which is what Sandia also does, in addition to that, this new bomb is being developed.
I don't want to sound like a high school debater here, but can't an argument be made that to have the bomb be guided by radar and to have the ability to dial down and to make more efficient its explosive yield is something that falls under the category of reliability, making the weapons more reliable?
I suppose it depends how you define reliability. The problem with this is that if the weapon, by being both more accurate and of lower force, is seen by the military as being useful against a target, it increases the possibility that the military, in fact, might recommend to the president that, you know, we can take out this target with this low-yield weapon flown by a stealth fighter so it can get through radar. And just having that capability, you know, raises the question of the usability of nuclear weapons. And, you know, we're dealing with a weapon of mass destruction that hasn't been used for the past 70 years, ever since the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August of 1945. So if we were talking about a conventional weapon, that might be fine. But if we're talking about a nuclear weapon, we are talking about a nuclear weapon. And because of that, any use of a nuclear weapon by anyone, you know, will lift this nuclear taboo, and nobody knows what the consequences are if nuclear weapons are ever used in a conflict.
But you don't believe that President Obama could be convinced to cross the nuclear threshold just because there's a radar attached to a bomb, right?
No, I don't believe that. But what's going to happen in the future? You know, what other technical developments are going to come along? Who's going to be elected? Who's going to sit in the president's office?
Has the defense industry here, in collusion with the defense contractors and the Pentagon, pulled a fast one, basically upgraded the capability of the U.S. nuclear arsenal in a way that is at odds with stated policy of the U.S. government, and that is going to have strategic significance going forward?
Yes, it appears that, in fact, is what happened.
Do you think the defense industry has New Mexico over a barrel in that its economy is so dreadfully depressed right now, and that this is in many ways the only game in town, and that essentially New Mexico has to do the bidding of this gang?
You know, New Mexico, now 70 years after the New Mexican desert was selected as the site for the very first atomic bomb test, the nuclear weapons enterprise and military have turned New Mexico into, you know, something of a colony when you look at the figures. When you look at the amount of dollars going into New Mexico, which is the second poorest state in the country after Mississippi, You have nearly 20% of the money that went into New Mexico in 2013, according to a Pew report, went to the two labs and the waste isolation pilot plant near Carlsbad. So, yes, the nuclear enterprise has tremendous power and influence in New Mexico. Again, you have this relationship where New Mexico needs jobs, and the nuclear enterprise can offer them.
Len Ackland is a contributor to Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Len, thanks so much.
Thank you.
More than a decade of struggles for the U.S. airline industry has pared down the players from a nimble 9 to a bloated 4. The end of regulation decades ago created competition, as was predicted, but the latest consolidation through mergers and buyouts has resulted in some suspicious trends that the Justice Department, the same agency that approved all the mergers, wants to take a closer look at. Domestic fares have climbed 5% over the past decade on top of inflation, and that doesn't include the new baggage fees and legroom fees and food and drink fees many airlines now charge. DOJ believes there may be evidence that the four major U.S. carriers, American, Delta, Southwest, and United, have colluded to limit the number of seats and keep fares high. David Koenig, airlines reporter for the Associated Press in Dallas, says the Justice Department wants to know why capacity, the number of airline seats and planes in the fleet, seems to be stuck.
Over the last decade or so, we've seen 9 major U.S. airlines shrink down to 4 because of mergers, and that seems to be having an effect on competition. The airlines were really struggling in the last decade. In the 2000s. You had a recession that began in early 2001, then you had the 9/11 attacks that hurt the industry, and several airlines, either some of the small ones disappeared and some of the big ones went through bankruptcy, and they were looking for ways to strengthen themselves financially, and they found that through mergers, and that has taken place.
They've also found new revenue by completely reorganizing the pricing scheme for tickets and the way that they charge for virtually everything that happens on a flight. Is this part of what the Department of Justice is investigating here?
The Department of Justice is looking into whether the airlines colluded, whether they worked together to limit the number of flights and seats so that prices go up. So they've asked the airlines for information down to even the regional level of what their capacity, as it's called, has been, and what they've said to each other and what they've said to Wall Street analysts, to see if there's any signaling going on that would violate antitrust laws. What is happening is that the average fare has been growing faster than inflation over the last several years as this consolidation has taken hold and left the surviving airlines in stronger position with a bigger share of the market at many, many airports.
What kinds of signaling would the Department of Justice be looking at that would constitute collusion?
Yeah, they've sent out a 2.5-page letter to each of the four big airlines. That's American, Delta, United, and Southwest. And they've asked them for a bunch of documents, kind of a, you'd call it a fishing expedition. But what they're looking for clearly is, did Airline A tell Airline B, hey, we want to hold down capacity so prices go up. Will you join us? That's clearly what they're looking for, and that investigation is in the very early stages. And interestingly, their case might have looked better a few months ago, because for 4 or 5 years, the airlines held capacity down to less than 1% for the entire period, well below the rate of growth in the economy, and that looked suspicious. In the last few months, though, the airlines have added more capacity, but they'll be looking for that kind of smoking gun email or maybe notes from a conference or a dinner where they all got together and said, hey, let's all limit our flights so that we can all raise prices. So that's the kind of smoking gun they're looking for.
But what was the Department of Justice expecting when these mergers were evaluated originally and apparently all passed some sort of test?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder if this investigation is not at least a little bit of a case of buyer's remorse. The Justice Department signed off on all the big recent mergers, but they may be thinking, well, maybe we should have taken a tougher stance against those mergers.
David Koenig is airlines reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you, John.
And here's something to take with you today. Wanted: pilots to fly drones from a safe room on the ground in front of a high-resolution digital screen and see the world, blow up terrorists, try not to hit civilians, sleep in your own bed every night. Be careful what you wish for. The Air Force might place an ad like that to deal with the fact that drone pilots have become burnt out. The intensity of shifting focus every day from tense drone cockpits to the kitchen table at home is just too stressful. Pilots dropping out from stress has forced the Air Force to reduce the number of drone flights. That's all for today. Respond to anything you heard on our show today. Just call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.